The Spinoff Podcast Network. Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
The Fold is brought to you by oOh!media, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Kia ora and welcome to The Fold for June of 2020. I'm your host, Duncan Grieve, and this is a podcast about the media in New Zealand. It's been a crazy, crazy few months, and the industry is obviously in a constant state of flux, but you add COVID-19 to the mix and there's just, you know, the motion within it is just kind of hard to get your head around. Because of the scale of the virus and its impact on everything, it meant that sort of storylines which might otherwise have assumed a pretty huge and public level just got kind of lost along the way. But the resolution of the NZME staff saga has been, I think, one of the big signal moments of this period of time, and the fact that it happened so fast and the way that it resolved really tells you a lot about this era and the one that we're heading into from a media perspective. So to briefly recap what happened, NZME was engaged in talks with Nine to buy stuff or to basically given permission to ask to be able to buy stuff, because there were a few regulatory hurdles that needed to be passed to be able to do that. They somehow, and we've yet to really receive a completely satisfactory answer on how this all went down, but somehow NZME gained the impression that were they able to get regulatory approval, then they would be able to buy stuff for a dollar, while at the same time stuff had basically assumed Nine had assumed that the talks had broken down. So that culminated in the extraordinary scenes of that Monday in early May when NZME told the New Zealand Stock Exchange that they intended to purchase stuff for a dollar. Stuff very rapidly followed up with a release of their own saying that talks had broken down and there was no longer a live conversation there. There was a court battle, and you know, that was there was talk of another acquirer. There was speculation about TVNZ, about Sky. And then on a Monday morning, exactly 2 weeks after the original NZME announcement, Stuff CEO Sinead Boucher announced that the previous evening she had in fact bought Stuff for a dollar. And yeah, that concluded this sort of long-running courtship between the two companies, which had lasted years, and brought with it a whole bunch of questions about both about the process itself and about where Stuff is heading. I have already interviewed Sinead on The Fold. She was, in fact, the guest on the very first episode of it. She rejoins us now and basically talks us through in real time both the deal itself and the last sort of 6-8 weeks for her running a media company, which went, you know, both had, you know, Stuff is still New Zealand's biggest employer of journalists and thus essentially had the biggest role in covering the COVID-19 era. She talks about what it was like to do that under Level 4, where on one side you had almost all of your advertising revenue drop away, on another you had the biggest ever online audiences for your work. You had your journalists in the gallery basically becoming almost public figures for a period of time. You had the collapse of Bauer, We discuss all of that in this interview conducted late last week via Zoom. And I think for anyone who has followed this, both the NZME Stuff saga and sort of been paying attention to what's happening in media over the past sort of months and years, I think it's a pretty illuminating discussion. So here it is, Sinead Boucher on The Fold. Kia ora, Sinead. Thank you so much for joining me here after about 20 minutes of very strange technical snafus that are endemic to the Zoom era. I basically just want to get straight into it. I'm like ravenous to hear about how this all went down, because you were the first guest on this podcast 6 months ago. You were the CEO of Stuff. 6 months later, you're still the CEO. You're also now its owner. Tell me about how that process, when it first began and how fast it moved.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's the date today? We're sort of mid-June, and so it's really only just over a month ago that it all began. Although this last month has felt like 6 months itself. So it was probably about the second week of May. And, you know, as you know, we've been going through this sort of ongoing second round of an attempted merger or sale to NZME for the Stuff business. Nine, our Australian owner, had been very clear from day one of acquiring Fairfax Media in Australia that it didn't want to own a New Zealand business. And we've really been up for sale for the sort of year or more since then, year and a half actually. So we'd gone through various sort of sale processes and then the second round attempt with NZME. And Hugh Marks, who was the CEO of Nine, rang me up and basically said, look, you know, I don't think this is going to happen, this merger. We, Nine, really want to just be wrapped up with the New Zealand business. It's a distraction for us. It's not something that's core to us. And I just can't see this going anywhere. And I can't see the business, the Nine business, sort of committing to Stuff long term. And so I got off the phone to him, and you know, I felt really sort of really gutted for the company and the staff after so long of being in this sort of process of being in a state of limbo, really, about ownership with an owner who didn't want to own us and, you know, didn't want to invest in us or do anything with us in the meantime. And this, you know, process with NZME, which had seemed like their only real real alternative to Nine ownership, was just seemed to be going nowhere. So I had a chat with my husband and Ramesh Vedilacharam, who's our CFO at Stuff. And, you know, I think we were all kind of the view that if NZME is not going to go anywhere and the ultimate end goal doesn't look very good for the Stuff business from, you know, Nine's point of view, I will, you know, I'd ring back and make an offer to do an MBO, which I did. So I rang Hugh back and basically said exactly that if he didn't feel NZME was going to play out, then I would step in and offer a dollar for the business just to take it off Nine's hands. And he said, yes, let's do that. So, and then that just sort of kicked off this incredibly intense couple of weeks of work.
So, totally. And where was that in relation to that? Because there was this amazing scene on the Monday where, you know, when Michael Boggs and NZME announced a sort of their intention to seek permission to buy it for a dollar, seemingly with, you know, the way it came out, it felt like they knew they had it, or that, you know, it doesn't seem like the kind of thing you'd do without the permission of or the endorsement of its owner. And then very quickly that unraveled. So where was this conversation in relation to that, and how did that sort of feel? Like, how blindsided were you by that announcement?
Oh, well, the conversation I had with Hugh was maybe just under a week before that came out. So as far as I knew, you know, everything was just sort of, you know, that they'd had whatever conversation they needed to have with NZME, and we were just sort of progressing on. So when that came out on the Monday, I was really blindsided and surprised. And it, you know, there's a very quick phone calls with Nine, and it became clear that they were very surprised by that move as well, because as far as they were concerned, there was no negotiations ongoing between those two companies or any deal to be done there at all. So that day itself was a bit, is this on, is it not on, or what, you know. It was an extraordinary day, actually, and an extraordinary, you know, statement. But, you know, we just sort of stayed the course and kept going. Nine said to me, look, you know, as far as we're concerned, we're negotiating with you and we really want to get this done. So let's go.
It's such an extraordinary thing. So back, and because there has been so much news lately, which we'll sort of get to later, but it just got lost in the torrent. But as an episode, if you just shrink it down to a New Zealand media history, it's quite an amazing one, because it didn't just end with that day. Obviously there were court proceedings that came out subsequently, which, you know, ultimately didn't derail it. But, you know, how did you feel sort of emotionally through that, because it must have been, it's a huge thing to consider acquiring the business, but it's also to have that, you know, going on in parallel is almost unimaginable.
It was, I mean, because even though on one level this was a, you know, it might have been acquiring a business for a dollar, but it was still felt like a massive undertaking to me. And, you know, I suddenly plunged into this world of, you know, corporate negotiations and deals in a way that I'd never had done before. But on the other side, so I was the buyer that Nine was talking to, but it was confidential. Within our own organisation, our staff were really worried about what this all meant, this NZME announcement and the NZX announcement, and, you know, the sort of sense that was sort of swirling around at the time. Quite correctly, I think, that Nine was not prepared to commit to the business long term. I mean, they've always been pretty upfront about their intentions to us. And so you can imagine how unsettling that was for our staff. And also, I was very limited in what I could tell people, so or say to people, or give them any kind of reassurance. So we'd come through the weeks before, you know, during lockdown and such, doing, you know, multiple video town halls a week with our staff, just keeping them up to date with where things are going, what's happening to the company, you know, how we're sort of navigating through. And then it sort of got to this point where actually there was something really big happening out there externally that involved staff, and I couldn't talk to people about it or give them any honest or transparent answer about what was happening. And I found actually that was the toughest thing for that week, because I felt that was the time when people really needed to hear from the CEO about what was going on. And I was, you know, I had my hands tied completely about saying anything either way, both because there was a court action looming, but also because I knew there was this buyer there, but that was me. And I was bound by confidentiality around that process as well.
I mean, and you know, talking about the staff like that, I so see that, because it's easy now that we're in level one, though, you know, if we keep watching quarantine, who knows how long that'll last. But, you know, life feels much more normal. But during that time, I mean, we had come out of lockdown, or we were starting to come out of lockdown, I think, but the whole, you know, with the collapse of Bauer, the redundancies at NZME and MediaWorks, there was just the sense of danger of you know, like that was in the air for media was so palpable. You know, how did that feel in the room, and how did those kind of broader industrial forces kind of impact on the deal and on the sort of the way it unfolded?
Yeah, I mean, look, it was a very real, not just a very real sense of danger, but actually a very real danger. You know, the collapse of Bauer, I think, you know, on one level, you know, it hadn't been a surprise that Bauer wanted to exit New Zealand, but on another, it was just utterly shocking that all of a sudden on a day, all these incredible titles and the history there were gone, you know, and it's still unsure exactly what might happen to some of those. But so there was that, there was the, you know, the various job cuts that were going around. And as a business, we ourselves, you know, roughly half our revenue came from advertising. And as soon as sort of, you know, or actually even before lockdown was announced, we had started to see a really serious impact on that. And once we went into lockdown, it basically disappeared. Not surprisingly, since everything shut up shop. So that period was a real danger zone for us, where we knew on one hand we had an owner who wasn't committed and wouldn't necessarily, we didn't feel we could rely on their support should we be in a position to need a cash injection or anything like that. And on the other, we could just see this sort of, you know, turbulence out there in the wider market. So, you know, we were really hunkering down, managing every day, the cash flow, the sort of sense of worry with staff, trying to be as open about that as we could with people. And, you know, asking for things like our staff to take a pay cut, which was a really big step, and incredible the response to that and the sort of support back from people. So when it came to that, you know, this is all the build up to that week where made the decision to offer for the MBO. And it was definitely a factor, you know, this feeling that if I don't do something, then the whole business could just go, because we have an owner who doesn't want to have a New Zealand interest, and there's no really, you know, obvious other alternative out there. And now is probably not the best time to find one either. So in some ways that gave me real, I guess the confidence in a way to do it, because it felt like it was going to be the best option for the people who work there and the health of the company. So I still really very strongly believed in Stuff as a business and the assets it had and the power of the journalism and the newspapers as well as the digital assets. And coming into COVID, we had been tracking along really well. We had basically matched our financial results to the previous year, which is the first time in a long time. And I knew that we were still had a good business under there once we came out of COVID. So, it was an incredible few weeks, actually, of that sort of turbulence and uncertainty and big things happening. That just seemed to lead on to other big things happening every day, every week, you know. So,
with the, yeah, absolutely, and with that sort of that really dark period. I mean, firstly, what was your reaction when Bauer collapsed, and secondly, you know, how close did the wall feel? Because I remember talking to you once during lockdown, and I think there was like 4 paid ads in the whole Sunday Star Times. And there, you know, like that must have been, you know, with hindsight, you look back and the curve went down, but we didn't know any of that at the time. It looked like that could have lasted 3 months. I mean, around the world, it essentially does continue, you know, in some variation of that. So, you know, even the prospect of acquiring it, yeah, like just sort of wrap up the darkest moments of that for us.
And I think, you know, Bauer was obviously a huge, you know, it just sends these seismic waves around our industry here in New Zealand and Australia too, I know, as the sort of first. And at that time, I guess there was a sense of, is it just the first of big casualty of what there'd been, in media reporting, been a lot of description of COVID as an extinction level event for news. And so there's a lot of fear and worry about that. And I think for us, even though pre-COVID we were tracking along okay, everything changed during those weeks, and it felt like anything could happen within a matter of days. I really during that time felt like instead of having my CEO hat on, I had my director hat on as a director of staff, and was making sure that I was and taking advice, external advice too, on navigating through a situation where we had to really watch cash flow, ensure we could pay wages, ensure we could pay our bills, etc. And when you actually couldn't really look ahead very far, you couldn't, no one knew what was going to happen in a fortnight, let alone how you'd track over months. And I think during that time, the advice that I got from various external, legal help and others was absolutely critical to trying to navigate through what felt like a very precarious time, not just because of the impact on our business from advertising closure, but because I didn't feel certain what our parent would do with us during that time, or what support or not we might be able to do. I think one thing that turned out to be a real advantage for us was sometime, quite a long time before COVID, we had made the decision to sell off our ventures, so Stuff Fibre and Energy Club, and look to do some new things, to reinvest the money in new things. And that sale, which came during that lockdown time, even though it had been many months in the making, was, it was great to be able to get that cash into the business and have it there in case we needed it. And as it turned out, we were able to navigate through those worst of those weeks just on our own resources and acting carefully. But it's... sorry, Doug.
The dog. I should say, you can't see this if you're listening, but Sinead's golden retriever has got what looks like a small crocodile in his mouth.
It actually is a small stuffed crocodile that she's dug up from somewhere. Our children have grown past small toys now, but every now and again the dog seems to find one somewhere in the house and appears with it.
Really stoked with it.
Good one. Sorry about that audio bomb of the dog. So it felt very every day felt like you were walking on a knife edge and you weren't really sure what might come by the end of the day. But I think when it came to the point of doing MBO, in some ways it made it easier because it was just another big thing to do after a few weeks of lots of really big things happening and, big decisions to be made.
The Fold is brought to you by oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa, with over 4,000 out-of-home advertising sites nationwide across both street furniture and retail centres. I'm super grateful to oMedia for enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
How do you feel now about Nine? Like, it must be such a strange thing to be owned for so long by someone who is so profoundly and publicly disinterested in owning you, with all that the hamstringing that goes on along with that. And yet ultimately I feel like, because there were other people around you, and Todd Scott was out there kind of publicly campaigning for months, if not years, and there would have been other interested parties who probably would have paid more than a dollar. But it feels like after all the kind of quite, at times sort of unpleasantness of it, that they ultimately made what is a very public-spirited move in, you know, selling it to management and to the probably the best possible acquirer?
Yeah, look, I think I feel very grateful to Nine for that exactly. And actually, there had been during the course of us being up for sale, there had been serious approaches and in some cases offers from various groups where, one, you know, part of the factor was, you know, eventually Nine saying, actually, we don't think this is a good owner for the New Zealand business. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, they wanted out. That was their primary, you know, motivation. And I think the other thing was, I actually really respected the fact that they were very nothing but honest about their intentions for us from day one, and never tried to sugarcoat anything or pretend their interest was anything but, you know, selling us on, which just took away one more layer of trying to say second guess what might be really ahead or whatever. And when the sale, you know, when it came up, and then once it got through, I received lots of really great messages from people throughout that business and wishing us well, and including a lot of the people there who worked for our former owner, Fairfax Media, who, you know, was absorbed by Nine. So, you know, I still feel there's a good, we have a good relationship with them there, but I do ultimately think that, you know, it, we didn't belong with them, and they felt it and we felt it, and, you know, we're much better to have our destiny in our own hands now and be able to make decisions that we think are not only right for our business but that feel right in the context of the New Zealand news landscape and the, you know, the expectations of our customers and readers here, rather than something that might have been more from a Nine, you know, Australian TV business. Which was not, you know, we weren't very similar businesses when it came down to it.
I want to get to the sort of the future and the strategy and some of the opportunity and tension that exists there. But just we've been talking about the business so far, but the business is one of journalism, and I'd love to touch on how journalism was changed and challenged and during lockdown, because you know I don't think it's a particularly controversial thing to suggest that there was a lot of very, very good and very important journalism practice during there, but there was such a palpable antipathy towards particularly the gallery, and Stuff has probably on balance the best and biggest gallery team in the country. How sort of aware of that, and you know, how did that feel for, you know, sort of watching and that all unfold during that period?
So I think, you know, the thing is that while as a business we were entering this period of incredible challenge, where the sort of the commercial side of the business and the money that funded journalism was just gone, on the other side, we have never had more demand for the journalism. And, you know, on Stuff, which was already, you know, regularly doing maybe 1.2 million visitors a day to the website, that doubled overnight once lockdown was announced, and stayed at those kind of highs for, you know, quite a while. It's come off that now, obviously, but it's still much higher than it was, you know, beforehand. And so on one hand, you know, business is even more challenged, but the journalism is even more in demand and needed. You know, it was really needed when you still had lots of things swirling around about, you know, 5G causing coronavirus and all sorts of things. That good journalism was needed more than ever. But what was really interesting to me, I felt that across all the companies, that New Zealand was really well served by journalism during that time, but I was really shocked at the way that the public reacted to the journalists during that time, particularly those gallery journalists, because obviously we were going through, you know, having these daily press conferences, very visible, you know, prime ministers, you know, speaking to the nation, but also to the press gallery. and the journalists asking questions, hard questions, sometimes questions that seemed maybe to the someone at home that they were stupid or disrespectful or whatever. And we just started to get all these emails and messages and social kind of messages in about, you know, how dare those journalists be so disrespectful and question the Prime Minister. They should be supporting what they're doing now, and, you know, they're just a pack of idiots. They shouldn't be behaving like that. And, you know, whether or not you supported what the government was doing was completely immaterial, because this was exactly the time when you need journalists to be questioning power about the big decisions it was making for us. And seemed to be this real backlash against that kind of work. You know, rather than just carrying the message through, the government message, the sense that if you're questioning it or bringing in alternative voices, that that was a bad thing to do. So that really struck me, and I know there were particular journalists, not specifically in our team, who really came in for a lot of personal attack during that time for effectively doing what their job is to do on behalf of everybody. I was going to say, I do feel those poor gallery journalists now, they've had the most intense weeks of their lives, and we're just about to enter an election campaign, so there shall be no rest for them.
I know. I thought Kelly Dennett's profile of Tova during that period captured the moment and the mood, and I think, you know, it was an important thing to have,
yeah,
almost for the historical record, because it'll be lost.
That's right. Tova is the person who came under the most attack, and still is, you know, for doing her job during that time. And she sort of became almost like the poster girl for evil journalists trying to ask bad questions. And so I found myself just with family and friends and things and Zoom calls, having to sort of explain why journalists sometimes ask the questions they do, and that there could be some context behind that that's not immediately apparent, in ways I've never had to do ever during a career.
No, it's so strange. It was almost felt like the fundamental underpinnings, or like what the function of journalism was, got lost, or you know, in the tension of the moment. But it's been quite interesting this week. I feel like both, because the opposition had the same thing, you know, that whenever they would ask, like, it's literally the clue is in the name, the opposition, yeah, has a particular role in a democracy, and both journalists and the opposition were certainly the least popular figures, never really high up there.
No,
but even
we
even
didn't have far more, to fall.
No, but it felt like a long way, yeah, still. But this week, you know, you see why those institutions exist and the value,
right,
of them, because those failings are just not—they're not going to be press released.
That's right.
I know the
other thing that was sort of frustrating for journalists during that time was the fact that everything became channeled through those press conferences daily. So even their normal channels of being able to get information, you know, various statistics or things through, you know, the DHBs or wherever it might be, that the official line was everything will come through that time. And it's never good that journalists can be denied information. And while I can on one hand understand the sort of, you know, need the government to be very strong and clear in what it wanted to do, when it comes to talking about the role of the Fourth Estate and the need to hold power to account, that is exactly the moment that you need that to happen. And you think about not just the stories that have come out this week about the breach of quarantine and the sloppy practices that sort of exist, but even during the lockdown, the stories about David Clark not following, you know, their own rules, those are all things that actually matter to be told. It's not journalists' role to support or carry the message of the government of the day. It's their role to question and challenge and, you know, shine a light in the dark corners there to see what's really in behind them.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, it was a strange period. And thankfully it does seem to be, people are sort of rediscovering the importance of it. Yeah, this week has been almost like a palate cleanser for that, which has been good.
And I do think actually that the sort of strange, you know, combination of lockdown, this massive, you know, change to the way we all had to live and work, and the peril it kind of put journalism in, you know, financially, at the same time it was needed more than ever, has actually helped people understand more about the importance of news media and the fact that it does need to be, you know, it does play a valuable role and it needs to be supported and funded. It can't be taken for granted. I mean, the Bauer collapse really showed people when those beloved titles like The Listener were gone, I think it was a real eye-opener for a lot of people about things the industry had been talking about for many years, about that sort of challenges it faced. So I think that when we did the change of ownership, with that came this incredible outpouring of public support, emails, messages, texts. I probably got, you know, maybe over 2,000 messages from around the country after the sale was announced. Some, you know, readers or some advertisers and things, but actually just a lot of people who wanted to sort of say how much they valued their local newsroom and it was, you know, important to keep that work supported, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that might not have been the same, say, a year ago when we weren't just coming out of one of these, this sort of global crisis and the sort of need for people to find good information and reporting about it.
I do want to talk about how the new ownership dynamically changes the reality for the business, you know, on multiple levels. But because I think that's fascinating, and I think will be instructive about how it all develops. And basically, you know, it's a bit of a bellwether of what the future of the media, a more sustainable and forward-looking media environment looks like in New Zealand. But before we do, I want to touch on what, you know, that government support package, which was announced with some fanfare and was supposed to be the first of two, the second of which we're still waiting on. You know, because as you say, like, there's a reason that journalism was designated an essential service. There was a reason that journalists had access to the Prime Minister for, you know, an hour or more a day. And it has been made very viscerally over the past couple of months, the importance of journalism. But what was your reaction when that package came out? And do you feel like and what is your sense of you know, what's holding it up, or what the government's sort of longer term intentions are, having very clearly signaled something that so far isn't really arriving?
So I think, you know, throughout, or actually before and during the lockdown phase, there were several forums where the media industry was able to talk to government about the financial stress and challenge it was on. And particularly during lockdown, you know, at the Select Committee, the Pandemic Select Committee, about the sort of really grave peril a lot of reporting faced, because the financial support that was already, I guess, struggling had just basically disappeared. And at the time, I felt that we got a really good hearing. There were plenty of opportunities to talk and to explain exactly and
frankly. Almost too many opportunities to talk.
Absolutely, okay. Yeah. I got sick of the sound of my own voice sometimes saying the same things. So when we heard there was going to be, I think there was an acknowledgement that the crisis had brought an immediate cash flow situation for companies that could tip some of them over the edge. And we heard there was going to be this first media package that was aimed at dealing with that immediate crisis that people were facing over days and weeks.
Triage
package. Yep. You know, yep. First stabilise the patient. And so there was a $50 million package announced. But it became very quickly clear to me that out of that $50 million, there was nothing in it for our company, and which maybe arguably needed that cash help the most. to keep going. So I think 50 million, I can't remember the exact breakdowns, but 40 million of it was basically aimed at helping broadcasters and some radio with transmission savings and transmission fees and some New Zealand On Air components. And there was about 10 or 11 million left that other companies, well, actually all companies could apply for in some way to help with their cash issue. And then later on, you know, I'm thinking it may have taken a couple of weeks, it became clear that that was only going to be not an extra assistance, but a prepayment of government advertising for the sort of year ahead. And so I think we finally went through it. In fact, we still haven't received anything from there, but we were able to apply to get the government to pay up front, effectively, what it would normally pay us across a year for its advertising. And you put that in, and then it got calculated against everybody else's request and divvied out. So you didn't necessarily get that much, and we won't. You got a proportion. And so for us, that's probably maybe just going to be in the nature of just over $1 million, which the cash crisis is past now. We were thankfully able to get through, but it's certainly not something that would be able to materially change, you know, the fortunes of our company. So
I mean, that's what's so strange, right? Like, because the media is a big word. It can mean many different things in different contexts, but what we were talking about at the time, and certainly what the government appeared to be targeting, was journalism, which is a subset of media. And the biggest employer of journalists is Stuff. And, you know, the fact that this package came out and it had almost nothing for you, and yet some other companies which employ journalists and do great journalism, but, you know, would employ maybe a quarter of that number, were given, you know, like 10, 15 million. And ultimately, this is a competitive environment, you know, for the hiring, the compensating, the, you know, like we all, you know, most of us get on reasonably well, but fundamentally, like, you want it just to, everyone wants to be at the start line, run as hard as you can and under the same conditions. How did that sort of sit with you, the fact that some of your competitors were given just far larger contributions, when suddenly their cost base and what they actually do, the function they perform, isn't necessarily comparable?
Yeah, look, and I probably, it wasn't so much that I begrudged others what they were getting, because I knew we were all in trouble in one way or another, or challenged in one way or another. But I just did feel deeply disappointed that after, you know, what I felt had been strongly conveying in multiple forums the immediate peril a company like Stuff was in when you had an owner who was, openly not committing to supporting the company, and then for there to be nothing there. You know, that day I just felt so angry and disappointed and worried too, because, you know, this wasn't about piling in some extra profits or anything for shareholders. This is a matter of survival for all of the newsrooms and newspapers we have around the country. And we have 49 newspapers as well as Stuff, as well as Neighbourly. And we do employ, you know, the biggest newsroom across the country of journalists in New Zealand. So not only did I feel like that then, but it just added to the kind of worry about what was going to be ahead for our company. And I know that part of the reason that it sort of ended up distributed that way was because of the government's worry about what was going to happen with Stuff ownership, and would they be putting in some money that might just get taken off to Australia and didn't really help things here. I think we were very lucky we were able to still navigate through that time. It was just really the combination of our staff being able to take cuts. We really ramped back on anything, extra, like
all the columnists.
The columnists, you know, we had to let a lot of really good contributors and columnists go. We had to stop putting as many pages in newspapers because newsprint itself is extremely expensive. All those things. So, you know, and the government has been has signaled that there is a bigger, more material package coming. And by bigger, that I think they mean in terms of its impact on a company like ours, which might be aimed to, you know, be more focused on supporting journalism as an industry and keeping that sort of essential service going, rather than you know, looking to help one company or another out of an immediate crisis. So that didn't come in the budget. When we were initially expecting it, we are still expecting that something will be announced within you know, weeks. That's the sort of signals we've been getting, but you know, the closer we get into election cycles and the more other things come on board, and also, to be honest, the further away that crisis point that we all felt during lockdown seems, the more worried I am about whether that, you know, what actually impact that has on whether or not that eventuates.
Yeah, that's sort of seems to me that it's, if it's not in the next few weeks, it just doesn't happen at all.
Sorry to interrupt. This podcast was brought to you by the Spinoff Members, a program that allows readers to contribute to the future direction of our coverage, facilitate the most important and hard-to-fund journalism, play a role in directing new areas of coverage. To find out more or to become a member, visit thespinoff.co.nz/members. Thanks!
Let's move on to something more exciting, which is the fact that you now own this business and can now sort of strategize and plan and build it out. Like, how does that feel, and what are you going to do?
It feels great, actually, because it's the first time ever in our history as a company, as a kind of collection of publications and sites, that we have been in a position to where we've been able to make our own decisions, you know, plot our own strategy, take risks, look for opportunities for ourselves rather than as part of a overseas or a big corporate owner. And that really changes the way you can look at things and how fast you can move, what decisions you make. So I've tried to stress to people a lot that even though I've bought the company, that hasn't changed any of the overarching dynamics that the news media face. It just gives us a different kind of chance to start to navigate our way through that and build a sustainable news media business. But I feel much more optimistic about our ability to do that now that we have that in our own hands to sort of decide and deliver. So firstly, you know, I took on the company, but I'd always intended to transition that into a sort of, I guess, a more permanent ownership structure that would give our staff a stake in it, you know, allow the potential to bring in other investors or partners should that be needed down the track. And that's the kind of stuff I'm working through right now. It's far more complicated than I'd ever assumed. I thought it's just a simple thing to ask someone to put in, but there's sort of so many implications, legal and tax and all sorts of things there. So, but I hope to get that done before too long. And we're also going through this sort of, I guess, you know, I think the sort of next 1, 2, 3 months is really about stabilising, trying to land on what the financial picture really looks like for our business when we're still in a, you know, we're coming out of lockdown. Advertising is definitely coming back. How much of that is a honeymoon with things going back to work? What's the sort of things likely to land at? So we really want to sort of just be stable, rebuild for the next couple of months while we build out our longer term strategy. And we already had lots of ideas and plans around that, but some of which would never have got through a corporate owner, you know, who view things in a certain way. And others which are really only possible because we've got the freedom to talk to different people, consider different things. And I think, you know, that the great thing that we have is that we have, I think, a huge amount of public trust in our business. Sometime during the lockdown, you know, one of those Colmar Brunton annual surveys of the most trusted companies or the companies with the highest reputations came out, and stuff had gone into that top 20. So we were thrilled about that. And people, I think, link us more closely now to the local news they get through their papers than they might have done in a Fairfax Media Days or a Nine Days. So, you know, what we intend to do is, you know, for a start, one thing we've already done is change all the our internal metrics and KPIs away from, you know, very straight audience financial ones to setting public trust as our key KPI and improvements in public trust as the key indicator that we want not only editorial but the whole business to sort of gear around, because I think that's absolutely essential for a business like ours to be able to grow and protect trust. And then out of that we have these platforms, Stuff and Neighbourly, which have massive scale. You know, we're right at, you know, still the top domestic brand in the company in terms of audience and scale, engagement, you know, lots of engagement. I think I view Stuff in particular as a platform rather than just a publishing site. And when you think about a platform, you think about all the different sort of businesses or things you could build within that or off that, either ourselves or in partnership with other companies in New Zealand. And that's the direction that we'll be really going hard in the next 1, 2, 3 years.
So, I mean, that's true of Stuff, but and I think I wrote about this at some point during that sort of period where it was acquired. But for Stuff to function and for it to be a platform, you don't necessarily have to retain ownership of those 49 newspapers. Is that something that you've given thought to, that and that might be part of like returning them to? It, you know, almost like the same process as Nine did with you, is that like a really interested community owner can, you know, like the town going back to owning its paper again for the first time in, you know, maybe 100 years, and then forming a relationship with Stuff in terms of the distribution of the content. Is that something that you've given thought to?
Absolutely. And some of the thought was in, had been in my mind well before the MBO. Again, not something that we could ever have sort of done while the whole business was up for sale. But now, I mean, those news, you know, some of our newspapers are knocking on 160 years old. I think the day I announced the MBO, the press in Christchurch turned 159. They're really important. And the way that we are organised is that all of the journalists who work across the country serve Stuff with content and then also serve their local newspapers if they're in an area where that is. So when we think about future models, you know, that journalism is still utterly core to Stuff, the website, and needs to be protected. And many of those print products are, I would consider, core as well, but a lot of others would actually thrive much more in local hands and with local people. But the model for that now, I think, is quite different than it would have been a few years ago, where, again, there's probably more of a partnership to be done there to help support that through, you know, whether it's production services or content or, you know, sales services, all the things that sort of are needed to help get a newspaper out. And I think, you know, that is definitely something that we, once we get through this period of sort of stabilising, seeing where things are at, you'll be looking at some of those models there. But our papers did really well during the lockdown too. Subscriptions went up, partly because people couldn't just walk down to their local dairy to pick up a copy. But we have seen, even coming out of lockdown, an increase in those as well. They're still increasing. And that's, you know, it is what it is. It's not going to be the sort of new trend that emerges to sustain us for years. But I think it still comes back to the fact that people really, there is value there, and people value those products as long as they're delivering something that adds to their life and their community. I have had among the emails and things I've had from people have been a lot of local publishers or people who might have been interested in becoming a local publisher, wanting to sort of ensure they could protect their local paper or potentially take it on themselves.
Is there a tension between, you know, this idea of staff shareholding, which is a beautiful one, but where you are making these sort of hard strategic decisions, whether it's redundancies or divestment of assets or reorganizations, which inevitably cause pain, even as they are often or nearly always essential to making a business, you know, stabilize and fit for the future. How do you kind of foresee managing the sort of need for a shareholder to be represented and able to have their voices heard, while also, you know, able to go about the sort of the hard business of managing and evolving a business at staff scale?
Yeah, you have to be able to separate, say, shareholdings or a sort of financial kind of stake from employment for a start. And I've tried to be very frank with people, again, that, you know, just because we're out of the woods in terms of ownership, or that's, you know, we've drawn a line under that, there's some still hugely difficult times to be navigated, and that will need to bring change and difficult decisions. You know, the one question I always get answered first from staff, no matter what forum I'm talking in, is, are there going to be more redundancies? And it's a question you can never say no to. You can never, you know, you have to be you're honest about the fact that we're going to have to keep going through a lot of change. So I think there are I've worked for companies before where staff had a stake, and there are various ways of doing that. And it was always very clearly divorced from the kind of decisions that had to be made for the business. So, you know, the way that we will set that up, we'll have to, you know, make sure that we can still do the things we need to do and not have people being able to, you know, I guess, block something that they think might risk employment, when actually if we don't do something, it could risk much bigger, something much bigger than that.
And we're already over time, so I'll let you go shortly. But one thing I just wanted to ask was actually a bit about Facebook, which I know that, you know, one of the things that we discussed in depth when I last had you on the fold was that sort of principled stand on not, you know, not putting money into them. I just wondered if you'd seen their latest, that sort of election type kind of transparency information, and you know, have been following the sort of the Section 230 tensions that, you know, Twitter's tagging Trump's tweets and so on. Do you feel like there is a kind of a growing up happening with social media and with the Big Blue one in particular, or does your sort of that misgiving, that kind of moral sense, sort of still persist?
Yeah, look, I think it is great to see some of those initiatives come in, such as, you know, Twitter marking, fact-checking Donald Trump's tweets, or political ads having to be, you know, have the transparency ruler run over them. But to me, they still feel like token, you know, PR things, really, rather than something that's about fundamentally changing the core of a company or the operation there. And while you might have one thing going on around politics, but on the other hand, you know, you still do have things like all the stories swirling around about 5G causing coronavirus, which we've actually seen results in people getting out there and burning down the towers and things like that. So I'm very cynical about that. I think they're good initiatives on their own, but they, to me, not something that signals a real change in the way that a company operates.
Do you think that there will be, in conversations with government or other people in business, do you think that there will ever be a sort of a sense that that sort of safe harbour section 230 publish but don't bear the consequences of the speech that happens on your platforms, which, as you say, everything from anti-vaccination, which is going to only get bigger as when the COVID vaccine arrives, to the 5G torchings. Like, it is exploding off the platforms and into lives in a more profound way than ever before. Do you sense that there might be a more of a desire to kind of place the responsibility for what happens on the platforms in a similar way to news publishers have always assumed?
Yeah, look, I haven't picked up any real drive to get that changed coming from the government or anyone else here. It doesn't feel like something that's got a lot of life or momentum at the moment. And I think until there is a change there, then, you know, you'll continue to see those companies act the way that they want to. But I do, you know, I think, look, even I've been closely following what's been happening in Australia with the ACCC's moves there to try and, effectively extort a levy from Facebook and Google based on the amount of news that has helped build those businesses to put back into the media industry, the news media industry there. And I think both Google and Facebook have really started to show their fangs about that once it started to get close to the wire. You know, there's always a lot of, you know, nice sort of initiatives about Facebook funding some news or contributing some, you know, a fund for this or that. But really, when the chips are down, there's going to be a really ugly fight there. It'll be interesting to watch how the Australian government responds to that. But Facebook's recent, view that they can do without news on their platform, they don't need it to operate, may well be the case. But to me, that leads to an even more Wild West environment there, where without any good quality, accurate information interspersed among, you know, who knows what, anti-vax, you know, 5G, white supremacist, all sorts of stuff, it's going to become a real morass. I can't see that being good for their business or good for society either, when so many people spend their sort of days absorbing information from there.
Mm. We're well over time, and you've got a lot to do, so I'll let you go. But congratulations on the purchase, and thanks so much for making time for me, Sinead.
Thanks, Duncan.
That was The Fold, brought to you by our partners at oMedia, making brands unmissable and public spaces better across Aotearoa. Huge thanks to oMedia for sponsoring this episode of The Fold and enabling us to make unmissable connections with Kiwis.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spinoff. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spinoff member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.